Hey man, how's it going, guys? Welcome to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm here on the Liberty Radio Network. Right after the best top of the hour news in world history. I mean, as far as, you know, talk AM radio style radio goes. Here, noon to 2 Eastern Time. LibertyRadioNetwork.com, LRN.FM. I think it should just be LibertyRadioNetwork.com. That way it tells you exactly what it is right there in the title. Easy to type. LRN's good too. Whatever. It's good. So I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Basically the shtick here is I'm an anti-government extremist. And I want you to also hate them. And so I tell you all the worst stuff about them that I know. That's basically the deal. If you don't hate them as much as me, then you're not done yet. We're working on you. All right. Today will be a cool show because today we're going to have Patrick Coburn and Andrew Coburn. Unfortunately, Alexander Coburn is no longer with us. As they say, he died of cancer, I guess, back a couple of years ago now. Anyway, two of the three Coburn brothers are around. And the deal was that Alex was more the polemicist and the, the ideological one. Andrew writes the books and Patrick does the war reporting. Andrew specializes. His reporting is more like on the higher level of, you know, generals as sources, Washington DC players and high-level power politics. Patrick reports on the results of their high-level power politics on the ground where the blood puddles are for the independent. And he writes books, too, of course, about the wars. So there you go. Andrew is going to be on. I forget who now. I didn't go back and look. I meant to. Somebody emailed me a few weeks ago and said, hey, man, get me Patrick Coburn on the show to talk about the military power of the Soviet Union. Eh? Well, there's a real interesting story there, you see. And in fact, I should Google this up on Amazon right now. So that I get the title right. Of course, his latest is Kill Chain about the drone wars. Rumsfeld. Man, have you guys ever read Andrew Coburn's book, Rumsfeld? You gotta read Rumsfeld. It's great. Rumsfeld, His Rise, Fall, and Catastrophic Legacy. The things that you will learn. Oh, yes. Here he's got a lot of books. Oh, you know, one of the first very serious adult political books I ever read was in 10th grade. I read his wife, Leslie Coburn's book, Out of Control. About the Iran-Contra scandal. Very good for my brain to know that stuff back then. And that was Andrew Coburn's wife, Leslie Coburn's book, Out of Control. The book about the Soviet military machine is called The Threat. Inside the Soviet military machine. And you know what? Damn me for not looking this up the other day, because here it is on sale for one penny at Amazon.com right now. I will take it. Hardcover, new, for a penny. Deal. Plus shipping, but, you know. $3.99 shipping on a penny. Support your local grandma. Usable copy. That, you got a deal, lady. I'm adding it to my cart right now, you know. Oh, good, and I'm already logged in. Oh, no, I'm not. You know, it's really too bad I didn't buy this book a week ago. I could have at least scanned through the damn thing. But there you go. The Threat by Andrew Coburn is now in the mail to me. Too late for the interview. But that's all right. You know, maybe I'll interview him again after I read it. What do you think? All right. Anyway, so that's the show today. Coburn's. The CK is silent. It's the Coburns. Today on the Scott Horton Show. So, news, the Hillary thing I'm going to talk to you about in a minute. First, I got to mention John Cornyn. I don't care if I have real proof or not. He's John Cornyn, and I hate him. Is he a member of the Ku Klux Klan? Quite possibly, yes. I don't know for a fact, but I have sincere reason to believe, good reason to believe, that John Cornyn is associated with the KKK. And that is because Anonymous has been publishing on Pastebin the names and contact information, not the home addresses, but the phone numbers, of Klansmen. And here they are at pastebin.com/YH2MUT9. R. And in a URL, it shouldn't matter if it's capitalized or not, right? Pastebin.com/YH2MUT9R. Political figures involved with the KKK. U.S. Senator from North Carolina, Thomas Tillis, a.k.a. Tom Tillis, age 55. Wife Susan Tillis, both living in Cornelius, North Carolina. Known KKK affiliated group, United Northern and Southern Knights of the Ku Klux Klan, Thornton. Number two, United States Senator from Texas, John Cornyn, age 63, wife Sandy Cornyn, both living in Austin, Texas. Known KKK affiliated group, United White Knights of the Ku Klux Klan. U.S. Senator from Georgia. More senators? Holy crap. Two more senators. John Hardy Isaacson, age 70, from Georgia. And Dan Coats. Isn't he retired now? He should say retired on him if they're not there anymore. Dan Coats isn't in the Senate anymore, is he, guys? Age 72. In fact, now I'm starting to wonder if John Cornyn's still there. John Cornyn's still there, isn't he? Yeah. Wow. So yeah, Dan Coats. You remember who Dan Coats is, right? Well, he features in Rumsfeld, his rise, fall, and catastrophic legacy. He was Bush Jr.'s first choice, probably on Colin Powell's recommendation, I guess, to be Secretary of Defense. But then he was soft on missile defense, said it was a waste of money, which of course is the whole point, you stupid idiot. So he blew his job interview. And then Cheney said, well, I got a guy. How about Don Rumsfeld? Oh, but I warn you, your father hates him. And Junior said, great, bring him in. Let's get him then. Because he is a stupid idiot. And that was how Donald Rumsfeld got the job. It's because Dan Coats was good on missile defense. That is, opposed it. Anyway, here's something else about... let me get back to the Klan thing here. I don't know if this is all true. Honestly, these are just accusations. But the thing is, I think it's true because I don't see much of a motive for Anonymous, whoever these anonymous people are, to falsely accuse a bunch of people of being members of the Klan. I haven't seen the proof. I'm not sure where the proof is. Oh, here's the guy's Twitter account. Let me go look at his Twitter. Maybe he claims, you know, where they got. Maybe they try to explain where they got their information from here. It's Operation Hoods Off. That's the hashtag on Twitter. Well, here mayors flatly deny Klan membership after their names were released online. I don't know. Oh, here's an article about it. Let's see. Right back in a sec, kids. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new ebook by longtime future freedom author Scott McPherson. Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms. This is the definitive principled case in favor of gun rights and against gun control. America is exceptional. Here the people come first, and we refuse to allow the state a monopoly on firearms. Our liberty depends on it. Get Scott McPherson's Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms on Kindle at Amazon.com today.
So you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods's Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support the Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom, the history and economics they didn't teach you.
All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. And, yeah, you know, it's, you know, foreign policy stuff. Coming up, Patrick Coburn and then Andrew Coburn. Patrick will be talking about the Turkish elections. The problem is I recorded him right after the show on Friday. The elections took place yesterday, and we already know the results. So you'll have to listen to the interview with that in mind, but I don't think it's going to spoil it very much because, you know me, I'm all over the place. And Patrick knew that this was going to happen. What happened was that Erdogan's party has a solid majority in the parliament, which Patrick sure seems to be taking as a FDR-level mandate for the president to break the law and do whatever the hell he wants. And he also seems to think it's going to have nothing but negative consequences for the war in Syria, for the wars with the Kurds, and et cetera like that. So I take the man very seriously and listen to what he says. I don't always agree with Patrick Coburn, but I always respect him. I think he's the best war reporter we got. All right, so yeah, that's going on. I got to say about Cornyn and the KKK. Do rich, powerful people join the KKK anymore? I thought the KKK is pretty much just working class schlubs, right? You have rich, powerful country club types join the KKK these days? It seems like they just call it the country club, but they don't get around and light crosses. We don't burn the cross. We light the cross, boy. Do they really get around? Do they stand around and do that shit? John Cornyn? I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if the guy is an avowed white supremacist. You know. But then again, I don't know everything about the Klan. Maybe there are still, you know, judges and millionaires and politicians and businessmen. And seem more like, I guess not. I thought not, but I don't know. And maybe there is proof of this. I mean, maybe they've shown. I went and looked. I read this article about it during the break here. And they just say, again, I have reason to believe. I don't doubt these anonymous guys too much in the sense that I think they have a lot of incentive to get this right, even though they could screw it up. But they don't want to just go off half-cocked falsely accusing people. They want to really nail some sons of bitches to the wall here. And getting it wrong is not a good way to do that. And they say here, they've tweeted out, I guess, anonymous, your Anon News is the Twitter handle. I guess they've said, well, I'm trying to sum up what I read in this article here real quick, that, they had hacked one of the Klan's Twitter accounts. And then from there, they were able to find out. Oh, here's the quote. We've gained access to yet another one of your KKK Twitter accounts. Using the info obtained, we will be revealing about 1,000 of your Klan member identities. So, I don't know. Obviously, some denials already. I guess we'll see what happens. That'd be interesting, man. What if John Cornyn says, yeah, so what, I'm a Klansman? And then doesn't resign and just gets away with it. I mean, we might be there right now in America, you know? I don't know. Yeah, there was a time where that would have been a scandal. But now we're back to times where not so much. I was telling some friends last night, I was saying, yeah, I think, you know, I guess I have to bet that Trump at some point is going to call Carson the N-word or something and is going to really, you know. But, and before I could finish the sentence that, you know, that would really hurt him, they said, and then that'll really definitely secure his nomination. You know, you may be right. Maybe right. I have Sim still 51-49 thinking on the chances that it's going to be Jeb. People who say that Jeb is out are misunderstanding. They think it's about votes and popularity. It's not. It's about money. It's about power factions. And America is not run by people. America is run by the bankers and the arms dealers, the insurance companies, the agribusiness firms, the Israelis, and, yeah, I don't know. I guess you could throw in the AARP, but that's just the pharmaceutical companies again, right? And they're the ones who pick. Goldman Sachs and Citigroup, they're the ones who decide. And Jeb has them all locked up, all those factions locked up. Not that he couldn't lose them, but assuming that he can keep his head above water at all, they are going to stick with him for the long haul. And just like I told you a long time ago, he's now actually parroting this. Rubio made fun of him for it in the debate, that you think you're going to be like John McCain and come from behind after everybody hates you the whole season long and then finally get the nomination. But McCain lost. It's not a very good plan. I think that was how he ended it. But anyway, he did bring that up, that Bush apparently himself has said, yeah, I'm just like John McCain in 07. I'm the rhino liberal centrist Republican that nobody wants until everybody else drops out and you realize I'm the only one who could possibly win the swing voters to beat Hillary Clinton on the other side. Or whoever. Same as always. Good strategy. You know? And of course, yes, he has to be somewhat electable by the masses, but that's not the count that's going on now. It's still very, very early. I'm still a year away from the vote here. But then again, you know, I thought Trump would have said something crazy enough to have botched it by now. And I think that the reason his poll numbers are so high, I mean, look at the guy. He's for partial birth abortions, raising income tax levels, or at least was at one point, for socialized single-payer health care and all stuff. And the conservative right-wing Tea Party movement, conservatives, voters of the Republican Party, they don't give a damn about any of that. Because they believe him when he promises to round up and deport 12 million Mexicans. And they're just, you know, salivating over that. They're willing to trade any of their other so-called pretended conservative principles. Because they believe him. Not only does he say he's going to do it, but they think he's really going to do it, man. So, unless he backs down from that, I think, you know, Jeb or anybody else is going to have a really hard time. It's hilarious reading, have you read the establishment press since the debate? Rubio is ascendant. That was what they said in the Washington Post. Yeah, Jeb's going down. Rubio's the guy. And now, of course, the Israel lobby, Singer and others are giving him millions of dollars. But Rubio, really? The stupid idiot who a couple of months ago implied that ISIS worked for Iran while they're at war? Lou Rockwell called him a dope in that interview with Tom Woods. It's a perfect description. It's exactly what he is. Rubio ascendant.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
Hey, all, Scott here for Samurai Tech Academy at mastersamuraitech.com. Modern appliance repair requires true technicians who can troubleshoot their high-tech electronics. If you're young and looking to make some real money, or you've been at it a while and just need to keep your skills up to date, Samurai Tech Academy teaches it all. And they'll also show you the business, how to own and run your own. Take a free sample course to see how easily you can learn appliance repair from MasterSamuraiTech.com. Use coupon code Scott Horton for 10% off any course or set of courses at MasterSamuraiTech.com.
All right, you guys, so If you look at Justin Raimondo's article today at antiwar.com, you'll see a link to this Hillary Clinton email. And I don't know if this was one of the 30,000 that she claimed were private that really weren't. I don't think anybody believes her that there were 30,000 private emails. The FBI has all of them now, is my understanding. I think we only have some of the ones she turned over. But not the other, the so-called private ones. They're still going through those, and we haven't heard yet. Correct me if I'm wrong, guys. We haven't heard yet how many obviously not private ones were lumped in, you know, deleted with those that were. But anyway, you can find the link to this one in Justin Raimondo's column at antiwar.com today. It's from Jacob J. Sullivan at the State Department to Hillary Clinton. See last item. AQ, that is Al-Qaeda, is on our side in Syria. Otherwise, things have basically turned out as expected. This is February 12th, 2012. See last item, page down, there's a spot report, has some other stuff going on here. And then the last entry says, Al-Zawahiri urges Muslim support for opposition. Al-Qaeda leader Al-Zawahiri called on Muslims in Turkey and the Middle East to aid rebel forces in their fight against supporters of Syrian President Assad in an internet video recording. Al-Zawahiri also urged the Syrian people not to rely on the AL, Turkey, or the U.S. for assistance. Oh, the Arab League. Turkey or the United States for assistance. That's from Reuters. Okay, now, you know what? I'm sorry, I have the soundbite here, but if I'd thought about it better, I would have Googled it up so I can get the exact date for you here. Oops. Yikes. Let's see, Hillary, CBS, 2012, Assad. I forget, guys, whether it was February or March. Here we go. Daily Caller has a link to it here. Hillary compared arming rebels to arming Al-Qaeda in 2012 is the headline of the Daily Caller. Flashback. February 2012. February 2012, and hell, here's the whole interview. Let's see. Is it going to work? Oh, no. My flash player is going to screw me here, guys. Hang on. Well, we don't have to play the whole thing. I got the clips for you, but let me get the date right. I want to get the exact date. Daily Caller only calls it February 2012. Let's see if they got a link back to the other one. No, I guess not. Well, you know what? I bet if I Google one of the quotes here, I can find the original CBS story. But anyway, so here is, here's clip one.
We know Al-Qaeda, Zawahiri is supporting the opposition in Syria. Are we supporting Al-Qaeda in Syria? Hamas is now supporting the opposition. Are we supporting Hamas in Syria? So I think, Wyatt, you know, despite the great pleas that we hear from those people who are being ruthlessly assaulted by Assad, if you're a military planner or if you're a secretary of state and you're trying to figure out, do you have the elements of an opposition that is actually viable, we don't see that.
Okay, so here's the article. It's February the 26th. Sorry, I should have that memorized. Actually made, at the time, I made a bumper sticker about it with the quote, are we supporting Al-Qaeda in Syria? And her ugly mug on it. February 26, 2012, CBS News. The headline is Hillary Clinton, Assad regime dishonors Syria. That's your headline. Assad regime dishonors Syria. And there she is, the 26th of February, so 2 weeks, after this, Oh, no. Yeah. I'm no good at math, especially live. It doesn't matter. This email's from the 12th. Six, and that makes that a four, and then another. She was thinking of this email. Right? When she said, hey, look, if we support the opposition in Syria against Assad, then ultimately we are helping Al-Qaeda in their goals, too. That's what she's saying. And then she pushed to continue doing that anyway. And based on, probably, I guess, this same kind of ridiculous one-dimensional thinking. In the words of Jacob J. Sullivan, Al-Qaeda is on our side in Syria. But for Christ's sake, just because America is on Al-Qaeda's side doesn't mean Al-Qaeda is on America's side. And look what happened just half a year later in Libya. Huh, isn't that funny? Al-Qaeda's on our side in Libya, guys. So they're arming and funding and helping Al-Qaeda guys travel to Syria to fight in the war. And they get stung to death. They're a maze. We put a base in the middle of a hornet's nest and then got stung. Doesn't that seem odd? But then here's the truth of it. Ayman al-Zawahiri urges Syrian unity against Russia, U.S., Shiites. Urges supporters to stop fighting amongst themselves. This is from yesterday. No matter how much America loves you, keep killing them, instructs the leader of Al-Qaeda to his legions that are, in fact, backed by the United States. The Army of Conquest, that's more than half Al-Qaeda. The whole damn revolution over there, three-fourths of it is the Islamic State and the al-Nusra Front, Al-Qaeda in Syria. Probably more than that. And then whatever so-called moderate groups, meaning the ones that are outright backed by the CIA, they're not moderate at all. They're horrible sons of bitches, just like the Al-Qaeda guys. Cut off people's heads, crucify them to death, execute people for refusing to convert. For refusing to convert. The moderates. Armed to the gills with American and Saudi money and tow missiles. And so, no, Al-Qaeda is not on our side in Syria. J.J. Sullivan, Jacob J. Sullivan, Hillary Clinton, you're just on their side. And you know, I was telling somebody that I know that, yeah, man, Obama and them, they've been backing Al-Qaeda in Syria this whole time. And the person who I know, but not from political stuff, you know, is looking at me like, man, are you going kind of right-wing birther kook on me? And I don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying it's because he's a Muslim secret terrorist usurper of the American presidency like some right-wing idiot. No, no, no. He's a secret conservative. He's an American conservative, moderate, middle-of-the-road centrist, Jeb Bush type. That's what he is. He's an imperialist and a militarist. And a Zionist. And that's what he's doing. He thinks he's smart. Back in America's enemies. See last item, Miss Hillary. AQ is on our side in Syria. And then compare that to the headline at antiwar.com. Zawahiri urges war against Russia, America, and the Shia altogether. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the great libertarian social network. They've got all the social media bells and whistles. Plus, you get your own publishing site, and there are classes, shows, books, and resources of all kinds. And I host two shows on Liberty.me. Eye on the Empire with Liberty.me's Chief Liberty Officer Jeffrey Tucker every other Tuesday, and The Future of Freedom with FFF Founder and President Jacob Hornberger every Thursday night, both at 8 Eastern. When you sign up, add me as a friend on there. ScottHorton.Liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here.
It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co.
All right, kiddos, welcome back. I'm Scott. It's my show, Scott Horton Show, here on Liberty Radio Network. Let's see. Talked about that. Oh, we'll switch them around. Andrew Coburn first, then Patrick. That's coming up here in just a few minutes. So a Russian plane went down over Egypt, and the Islamic State immediately took credit for it. But they would, wouldn't they? But then again, they would shoot it down if they could, wouldn't they? It seems less likely that it was a bomb on board. I believe the plane was coming from Russia to Egypt. And then it didn't fall out of the sky until it was over Sinai, right? So, you know, it could have been a bomb. All the claims of the governments involved are that the plane was cruising at an altitude that a shoulder-fired Stinger would not be able to reach or anything like that. But then again, are they admitting Stingers? Or just some kind of man pads? Because, you know, I don't know. On the other hand, and I gotta tell you, this is my gut on this. I apologize for my gut happening to coincide with what may be the government's version of what happened here, but I did read a report that could have been total made up CIA propaganda lies. I don't know, man. But they said that this plane back in 2001 or two had a bad landing where the nose was too high and they hit the tail on the tarmac, which I always wondered about that, like especially on takeoff. You know, how are they sure that the tail never hits, man? They must do that carefully somehow. Anyway, and they said that, hey, you know, they went back and retrofitted it and this, that, the other thing. Then I also saw a thing that said, you know, the co-pilot, I guess, had been complaining that this plane was a ramshackle old deal and wasn't really safe to fly. I don't know, man. Sometimes planes fall out of the sky. Other times they're shot down by guys with American missiles that they got out of Gaddafi's inventory when America took their side of the war. I don't know. I don't think we know. I don't know. I guess I'm leaning toward it was just a thing that happened because, I don't know, the plane supposedly was at cruising altitude, too high to hit. And of course, the Islamic State, for a gigantic thing like that, a Russian plane, they're going to claim responsibility one way or the other. But anyway, I'm withholding judgment. I'm just, Oh, no, see, I got it wrong, man. Holmes and my buddy Bill in the email says it was, no, the plane took off from Sharm el-Sheikh. Oh, so, yeah, maybe someone did infiltrate a bomb in there on the Egyptian. Or maybe still it was shot down. I don't know, but look forward to more of that kind of thing. I mean, you got to figure, well, you've been warned. Yeah, after you overthrow Gaddafi, then what's going to happen to his weapons? Look, everybody, his weapons are on the loose. Look, they're going to Syria. Look, they're going to the Sinai Peninsula. I mean, that's been reported since 2011, right? Since 2011. Of course, the war in Libya spread immediately down into Mali throughout 2012 and 13. Supposedly, the French got a lid on it now, but there's still some fighting there. Very little journalism out of there, as far as I know. I don't know. But so, yeah, I don't know. Maybe the plane broke in half. Maybe it was shot down. But, you know, I don't know, man. I saw another thing this morning where Adam Johnson from FAIR was tweeting out about the FBI is wanting to clamp down and look for signs of Islamic radicalization in schools and deputize all the New York schools into looking for signs of Al-Qaeda-type activity among the kids and this and that. And why? Because of imaginary fears about blowback or worse, more obvious, backdraft from Syria. Well, who's been telling you all this time, man, don't back the Mujahideen in Syria? Look, everybody, look at all the American and especially European wannabe jihadis who are traveling to go and join up with the al-Nusra Front and with the Islamic State. Some of these guys are going to be unaccounted for. Some of them are going to be able to get back into Europe, possibly even to the United States. The FBI came out, what, it was about a year ago or something, right? We did a story about, Jason Ditz wrote this up at news.antiwar.com, where the FBI was like, oh, yeah, you know, we haven't been keeping tabs on which all Americans have traveled to Turkey to travel to Syria to go and join the jihad. We hadn't thought to, you know, compile that information in one place or anything. Did you want us to maybe consider starting on that now? Yeah, it's really difficult when the leadership of both parties and the entire national security state are all guilty of the highest treason up to their eyeballs, backing the bin Ladenites in Syria. It leaves an FBI manager confused. Well, wait a minute. If the CIA recruits a kid to go and fight in Syria, is he a bad guy or a good guy? They get confused easily. Anyway. And that was one of these guys who was prosecuted by the Department of Justice. His defense was that the CIA had recruited him. And maybe that wasn't true, but maybe it was someone pretending to be a CIA agent who recruited him, or maybe it was a CIA agent who recruited him. His father said that that was why he thought it was okay. He was being sent by the American government. Now you're going to prosecute him? Yep. Well, it is treason against the American people, if not against the American government. So you got to learn to discriminate about who you're betraying. It was mostly a bunch of civilians who were killed on 9/11, remember? Yeah, the Pentagon got hit too, but by a plane full of civilians. Anyway. What time is it? Good. Okay. By the way, I wanted to mention to you that when Israel commits war crimes all day long against the helpless civilian population of the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, East Jerusalem, that there are consequences for you. So even if you don't care as helpless Palestinian children lay down and die on your dime, you should know that at least the official story of the assassination of Bobby Kennedy is that the guy that did it was mad because Bobby Kennedy was helping to sell a bunch of weapons to the Israelis for use against the Palestinians. That's the first major case of blowback terrorism against the United States from our support, from U.S. government support for the Zionist project there. And I'm not sure that's really true. I think that guy Sirhan was probably set up one way or another, but I don't really know. But that's the official story, is that that's why he did it. And you're supposed to think, oh, well, if people hate us for doing the right thing and helping our Israeli friends be nice all day, well, tough. But the reality is that it's Israeli crimes that our government is abetting injustice on a vast scale. And that's why it's causing such a problem all the time, see. And then, of course, the first World Trade Center attack, Ramzi Youssef wrote a letter to the New York Times, explained why he did it. He was avenging the Palestinians for American support for Israel, as well, of course, as the Iraqi civilians who were being butchered and starved in the bombing and blockade of the no-fly zone, Bill Clinton peacetime days. Well, actually, it happened right after Clinton took office, so it was H.W. Bush's war, and he had started the no-fly zone and kept the blockade the whole time. So the blockade really started in the summer of 1990, of course. So then there was that. And then, of course, bin Laden in his fatwas of 1996 and 1998 went on and on and on about Israeli crimes against the occupied Palestinians, and at that time, of course, the occupied Lebanese as well, on America's dime, and cited that as part of the reason for their strategy of hitting the United States first. How can we ever end this oppression when the Israelis, the Saudi kingdom, the Egyptian military dictatorship, etc., are all supported by the far enemy, the Americans? And so that you could include 9/11 in that. And then, as Ray McGovern always likes to point out, the whole original Battle of Fallujah started because of the Israeli assassination of Sheikh Yassin, who they had helped build Hamas in the first place. And that caused a massive protest in Fallujah, which led to the rioting and the lynching of the Blackwater Guards, which led to the first clampdown, the first real war against them and against the Sadrists in Najaf, who rose up in solidarity with them at the time. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still. If you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. As I promised all Coburns on the show today, in half an hour, I'll play the interview I recorded Friday afternoon with Patrick about the Turkish elections and the war with the Islamic State and all this and that. But first, up right now live, is his brother Andrew Coburn, author of Kill Chain, about the drone wars, and before that, Rumsfeld, his rise, fall, and catastrophic legacy, and a whole lot of other books besides that. And I mentioned to you earlier, and I like mentioning this all the time, that the first real serious political book I read when I was in 10th grade was Out of Control, about Iran-Contra by Andrew's wife, Leslie, which really helped inform my point of view a lot as a young kid. Anyway, welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Andrew?
Hey, great to be with you. I'm doing fine.
Good. Very happy to have you here. And so, man, I'm really sorry. I'm looking at the Amazon page now, and I could get, I actually just ordered the book, The Threat, Inside the Soviet Military Machine. They got them for a penny.
Yeah, good bargain, good deal.
Very good deal. I mean, believe me, I know it was $20 and worth every penny back in the 1980s, but that was when it came out. Was when? What year was it? 83?
82.
Oh, 82 even. Yeah, it says 83 here. But so, yeah, very early on in the Reagan presidency here. And so anyway, I got an email from a guy that said he had just read this and he wanted me to interview you about it. And I wish I'd gotten on the ball and ordered the book right then. But so I haven't read it. But I did just read all the reviews of it on Amazon.com, and I like the one where the guy says, I read this book and rolled on the floor laughing. It is so very believable.
That's good.
He wasn't laughing at you. He was laughing because he believed you. He thought you were right. So now, in 1982, I was just a little kid. I was in first grade. But I remember, it was brinksmanship, and it was the Reagan years, and detente was off, and the Cold War was back on. And more or less the way I learned it was that their empire was as powerful as ours, and that we are going to be at permanent standoff for the foreseeable future. And, I don't know whether you outright predicted the complete demise of their system in this book or not. I wouldn't be surprised if you did, but you sure seem to, be seeing right through all the propaganda, the conventional wisdom, as I was exposed to it at the time, all the way through, huh?
Well, that's right. I mean, actually, you've got one thing slightly wrong. We weren't told that their empire was equal to ours. We were told that it was maybe stronger, and that unless we spent ourselves into bankruptcy in a hurry, they would be all over us, and there'd be, you know, we'd be under a communist system before you could turn around. In fact, there was a, do you remember a movie called Red Dawn? Actually, it was pretty good, about the Russians invading the U.S.
Oh, yeah, around. I loved it when I was a kid.
It was a great film, great film. But that was the general, that was the official ethos. I mean, when it had started, it really got going in the mid-70s. It'd been going forever since about 1948, but it really ratcheted up in the mid-70s, coincidentally, or maybe not coincidentally, as the Vietnam War ended and there was somewhere, you know, the military-industrial complex had to find some other way to justify its enormous income. So that's when they started ratcheting up the Soviet threat, and we were told that the Soviets could actually do a first strike, could actually win a nuclear war with the first strike, unless we spent an incredible amount of money having a mobile ICBM, the MX, which was going to drive up and down the interstates, this ICBM. There were all sorts of other things. And I set out I thought this is kind of ridiculous, you know, that the Russia is, you know, many estimable aspects to it, but it was a poor country, a poor compared to the US. And how come we're told on the one hand that communism doesn't work? You know, it's a hopeless system and it'll never work. On the other hand, it somehow has produced this incredible military machine where they have, in Ronald Reagan's immortal words, more missiles, bigger missiles, better missiles than we have. I remember him saying that. And that their planes work better and their soldiers are taller and stronger and everything else is better unless we, you know, really strive harder and give much more money to Lockheed and people like that. Mm-hmm. So I set out to look out, you know, to see what was really going on. And at that time, there was a huge influx of Russian immigrants into New York, where I was living at the time. And I started talking to them, and it's left a part of this deal in the 70s. They'd let a lot of people, a lot of Jewish Russians or Jewish Soviets out around in the 70s. And a lot of them, they all had to say they were going to Israel, but the moment they got out, most of them wanted to come to New York very reasonably. And so I started interviewing them. Of course, all the males had been in the army, conscription in Russia, a little recognized fact over here at the time. So I started talking to them about their military experiences. And they all said to a man, it's a complete shambles. You know, nothing works. We were hardly trained at all. Everyone's drunk all the time. All the weapons break down all the time. You know, it was more or less as you might expect.
Yeah. So my father-in-law was in the Red Army in Afghanistan.
No kidding. What did he say?
Well, they had one pair of boots to share among everybody.
Oh, man.
You know, they were freezing their asses off and mostly sitting around getting high and doing nothing.
There you go. I mean, for instance, there was a plane they had called the MiG-25, which was meant to be this wonder plane that would, you know, just outclass, fly us into the ground. I mean, it was going to be the cutting edge of the communist menace. And then a Soviet Red Army, Red Air Force pilot defected, Viktor Belenko, he was called, and he landed in Japan with this plane. It turned out to be very inconvenient because it turned out this plane was pretty much of a dog, and you know, it ran out of gas almost immediately, couldn't maneuver, it was hopeless in so many ways. But the thing I liked that he reported, which I had in the book, which was that the hydraulics, you know, along with the gasoline it used alcohol as sort of a pure alcohol, as I think in the hydraulics. That meant that every MiG-25 base stank of gasoline, of jet fuel, because they drain off the alcohol to drink. But to keep the book straight, if you used, you know, X amount of alcohol, you had to have used Y amount of jet fuel. So to keep the book straight, they just poured the jet fuel into the ditch. That's so the whole base stank of jet fuel because they'd been drinking all the... that was just one example among hundreds I came across. My favorite one, which got a lot of play here at the time, was the automatic loader on the main gun of the T-72 tank. And, you know, this was in vogue. You know, the Soviets are so far ahead of us. Man, we have to load our the shells into the R-tank guns by hand, they have an automatic loader that does it automatically, which therefore, you know, sounded like a better. And what I found out was that a thing had an unfortunate habit of loading the shell, loading not just the shell, or sometimes the shell, and sometimes the gunner's arm into the gun. So you had a lot of one-arm T-72 gunners in the Red Army armored division. So I mean, it was, anyway, the thing was, the whole point of this exercise was not to denigrate the Soviet Union, but to point out how we were being fed lies. I mean, the military knew all this perfectly well. This was no, I mean, I got most of my stuff from, you know, from the military here.
Sure. Yeah, the bomber gap and the missile gap, and this is the whole history of the whole Cold War is some made-up gap or another, just to cash welfare checks for millionaires, that's all.
Right, exactly right. It was all a lie, and it was a lie. And I also found, by the way, that the Soviet military, meanwhile, were telling lies about us. So it was it's got the image of these two sort of fat drunks propping each other up. And the one big mistake, the huge error I made in my thinking, I did kind of say this couldn't last, you know, how decrepit their system was. But the big mistake I made in my thinking was, well, once the Soviet Union goes away, if they collapse, then this, you know, the scam won't work here anymore. And that's where I was dead wrong.
Saddam will fill in fine. South American drug dealers, whatever you got. David Koresh.
Or even no one at all.
Yeah.
Because when they ran out of threats for the time being before Al-Qaeda appeared, they were talking about...
Pablo Escobar, yeah. Hey, wait, hold it right there, Andrew. We'll be right back after this, y'all.
I love Bitcoin, but there's just something incredibly satisfying about having real, fine silver in your pocket. That's why commodity discs are so neat. They're 1-ounce rounds of fine silver with a QR code on the back. Just grab your smartphone's QR reader, scan the coin, and you'll instantly get the silver spot price in Federal Reserve notes and Bitcoin. And if you donate $100 to the Scott Horton Show, he'll send you one. Learn more at facebook.com/commoditydiscs. Commoditydiscs.com.
Hey, I'll check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism Versus Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our status enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism Versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org. Hey, y'all. Welcome back. I bit my tongue there a little bit. All right, y'all. Welcome back. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm on the Liberty Radio Network here, libertyradionetwork.com. LRN.FM, live, noon to 2 on the weekdays. Join up the chat room. Check out the archives. All that stuff at scotthorton.org. All right, I'm in the middle of talking with Andrew Coburn. He is the author of the new book, Kill Chain, about the drone wars, and before that, Rumsfeld, his rise, fall, and catastrophic legacy, which is so great. You gotta read that book, man. Anyway, we're talking about this one that he wrote way back in the 1980s, in the early 1980s, 1982. You can get it for a penny right now, guys. They got 63 of them used, 34, in paperback and in hardback, 34 paperback for a penny right now, guys. At Amazon.com, The Threat Inside the Soviet Military Machine. And what a complete piece of junk it was. And so at the break, I just made up the last part. So at the break, we were talking about, I'm sorry, I was stepping all over you as we were going out to break there. Andrew, you were trying to say something making fun of the lack of an American enemy for the military-industrial complex after the unexpected by them dissolution of the Soviet Union and how they were trying to make do before Osama bin Laden there.
Right. You mentioned people like Pablo Escobar. Quite right. I mean, I remember the phrase, the jargon phrase that crept in was asymmetric non-peer competitor. And that meant, you know, the island of Grenada. Well, Grenada was earlier, but that meant some jerk on a street corner.
Manuel Noriega for a minute. And then, of course, Saddam Hussein made the perfect whipping boy for all of what Americans consider peacetime through the 1990s, but sure as hell wasn't for the people of Iraq then.
Well, that's right. We were, you know, we were, he was a big threat at the same time we were, thanks to us, the country was starving to death, you know. Now we've got, well, now, I mean, the happy days are here again, though, because we've got the Russian threat back, sort of. I mean, you know, if you listen to the way that the, you know, you should, really should listen to what the generals are saying, like Dunford, this, this new chairman of the Joint, chairman of the Joint Chiefs, he's very scary. He wants to send heavy weapons to Ukraine. He, you know, they're amping up, they're sending, you know, more troops to Europe. And he, I mean, I've been told that, you know, suddenly the military has turned a lot more aggressive, you know, in Washington, demanding greater say in policy, of course, more money, and just generally throwing our weight around in a way they haven't done, hadn't been doing recently. Mm.
Yeah, well, in fact, going back, I guess I probably interviewed you about this at the time. You had a blog at Harper's Magazine about the sheer joy. There's no point in hiding it. There's no secret, dark, smoky room where the secret society conspires. It's just a meeting of lobbyists, of arms dealers, saying three cheers for the new Cold War. All right, guys.
That's right. That's right. The I mean, they're so happy. The champagne corks apart. Yeah, I did. We were talking about this before, where someone, a source of mine who was at a meeting of defense contractor lobbyists, and I asked him what the mood was, and he called it, he said, borderline euphoric.
Yeah.
I mean, so,
there you go.
You know, so yeah, Ukraine's looking good. Now we got, you know, now, I mean, did you see this piece in the story about, you know, Obama sending special forces troops to Syria?
Sure.
And the Times, New York Times, in its article on this, sort of halfway down, it said this could pose problems if they bomb U.S. troops. Well, the American soldiers are meant to be miles away. I mean, theory, you know, on the ISIS front. But here it sounds like they'll be with, you know, the moderate CIA-backed rebels, as they're called, you know, the Russians are bombing.
Yeah, that's a lie. That's working directly with the al-Nusra Front that's still sworn loyal to Ayman al-Zawahiri.
Exactly so. Exactly so.
Yeah, no threat, right? There's no threat of... Nobody ever thought the Russians were going to be bombing Syrian Kurdistan. So, well, yeah, it sounds exactly like that must be what the Times was alluding to there.
Well, yeah, this was kind of interesting. No one told us that. But there you go. Yeah, no, it's, I'd say, you know, things are looking good for the military industrial complex, which is a concept people ought to use more often. Yeah. As the, you know, this budget deal, that was just announced with great fanfare and acclaim in the press, you know, that's a lot more money for them. Less money for old folks on Social Security and Medicare, but hey, someone's got to pay for all this.
Well, it's always $1 trillion a year. Robert Higgs at the Independent Institute and the guys at Mother Jones and the National Priorities Project, all of those at least, and I'm sure there are more, have added it all up. And when you include the money for the nukes and everything else, it's easily $1 trillion a year.
You really ought to add in the VA too.
Yeah, right. Well, yeah, I think that's in there, including the cost of VA. Yeah.
Yeah, $1 trillion a year is about right. Yep. Yeah, I think it was Winslow Wheeler. I think of the.
Sure. Yeah. There's another one.
He did it first, I think. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, and of course, it can fluctuate within maybe a couple of $10 billion, and then we get to hear him cry out loud about how it's the weakest army we've had since before World War I or whatever.
Well, that's right. That's right. Exactly. So, I mean, this outrageous thing that's going on where they're trying to eliminate the one airplane the Air Force has that is actually of some military use, the A-10.
Right.
And they want to do that because it'll save $4 billion a year. I mean, that's what they spend on their executive jets.
Yeah, and then so they'll have more of an excuse for needing the F-35. Well, now that we don't have the A-10 anymore, how are we supposed to provide any ground support at all? You got to give us more F-35s.
Forget the F-35. We're really off the races now with the new bomber, the B-3, which they've they've just announcing the contract for, even though it doesn't exist. It hasn't been built. There's no prototype. We don't know what it looks like. It's all secret. And yet we're already committed to spending $80 billion, which, you know, multiplied that by 10. And they're going to immediately start shoveling contracts to the shoving out the contracts before the thing is even properly designed, because they want to get they want to get so many congressional districts sort of tied into this that it'll be impossible ever to cancel.
All right, now, but hang on here, Andrew. Let me play devil's PR man here for a second. Obviously, everybody knows that NATO expansion and America's nefarious role in Syria and all this is that the Russians, I'm not justifying anything they're doing, but they are clearly reacting to the American empire here. But let's go back to the 1980s for a second, because back then there really was a USSR, and it really did control, you know, it was the hugest country in pure land mass in world history, of course, a massive empire occupying all of Central Asia and Eastern Europe. And all the criticisms of your book on Amazon say, yeah, but you're missing the point, Andrew Coburn. And the point is that even if their tanks were pieces of crap, they had so many of them. One guy says they considered their troops to be as expendable as ammunition, the way our side looks at ammunition. So it wasn't a fair fight when it came to the numbers and or the way that they would be used. And so, you know, and in fact, I'll add one more thing to that. I know a guy used to make nukes for the U.S. government. And what he told me was back then that they thought that, man, you could have however many thousands of tanks pouring through the folded gap, and America would never be able to stop them without nukes. They could conquer all of Western Europe, and it was nuclear fusion keeping them at bay. That was why he woke up in the morning and went and did his job, to protect freedom from them. He believed in it, and he's no dummy. He knows how to make nukes. So, you know, maybe there was more of a threat there than you're letting on.
I disagree. First of all, we know now that they had no intention of pouring through the Fulda Gap or anywhere else. I didn't talk about intentions in the book, because that was always the argument. I pointed out, in fact, that, you know, those huge tank numbers were mostly a myth. I mean, they had a lot of tanks, but most of them didn't work so good, and quite a lot of them didn't work at all. You know, they talked about the incredible number of Soviet army divisions that, you know, it's been 35 years since I wrote this stuff.
Sure.
But, you know, that they had hundreds of divisions and we had practically no one, you know, a miserable 15 or 20 divisions or something. But I point out, you know, they had category one, their divisions were broken down into three categories, one, two, and three. And it turned out that category three divisions basically were a flag and an outhouse, which, you know, in the event of total war, they'd be mobilized and put into action. But that was going to take months and months. Category two divisions weren't much better. And category one divisions, despite all they were cracked up to be, you know, even we found out, I said, look, they aren't what they're cracked up to be. First of all, there aren't as many of them as people say. Secondly, they're all under strength. And thirdly, they're not really that well trained. I mean, and that was confirmed when the wall came down, and you could actually go and visit, you know, the cracked unit of all, which was the 20th Guards Army. It was the crack division stationed in East Germany outside Berlin, and they were all busy selling their belt buckles and caps to buy food. this was the great, you know, knife that was poised at the throat of Western Europe. Not really. So yeah, that people still, you know, that was the old, you know, the fallback argument for the military industrial complex. Once you show that the planes and tanks weren't so great, they'd say, oh, but there's so many of them. But, you know, you had to look at really was there so many, and then so many of what, you know,
right.
So I rested my case then. It's still resting.
I see. All right. Yep. I'll buy that. Hey, listen, I'm sorry I kept you over time, and I got to let you go so I can start your brother's interview on time here in just one second. But thank you very much for your time again on the show, Andrew. Appreciate it.
Okay. You're welcome. Take care.
All right, y'all. That is Andrew Coburn. He wrote Kill Chain and a whole mess of other great books, including The Threat Inside the Soviet Military Machine back in 1982. We'll be right back. Hey, y'all. Guess what? You can now order transcripts of any interview I've done for the incredibly reasonable price of $2.50 each. Listen, finding a good transcriptionist is near impossible, but I've got one now. Just go to scotthorton.org/transcripts, enter the name and date of the interview you want written up, click the PayPal button, and I'll have it in your email in 72 hours max. You don't need a PayPal account to do this. Man, I'm really going to have to learn how to talk more good. That's scotthorton.org/transcripts.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com.
All right, y'all, introducing the great Patrick Coburn, Middle East correspondent for The Independent, independent.co.uk, and author of a great many books on the Middle East, the latest being The Rise of Islamic State. Welcome back to the show, Patrick. How are you doing?
Great, thanks.
Very happy to have you here, sir. Everything you write is pretty much very important here. I want to focus on here. Turkey election. Could bitterly divided nation be only a few steps away from dictatorship? And then the other, Russia in Syria. Airstrikes pose twin threat to Turkey by keeping Assad in power and strengthening the Kurdish threat. And to the end of that headline, we could add, Obama is announcing today that they're putting special forces. I don't know if they're already there or not. I assumed they already were, but they're putting special forces on the ground in Syrian Kurdistan, for use against the Islamic State as well. So, very interesting, very complicated subject matter here. We got a leader of Turkey who's got parliamentary elections on November the 1st, right? Please explain what all is riding on those elections.
These elections will decide whether the president of Turkey, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, who's been the leader of Turkey since 2002, gets back his majority in parliament, which he lost because the Kurdish party did well in the last election in June. This had very serious effects here because this was the first time that Erdogan had not had a majority for 13 years, and he reacted to it by basically moving against the Kurds, starting a war against the Kurds again in the southeast by accusing the Kurdish party of being secretly in league with guerrillas and so forth. So there's been an atmosphere of crisis in Turkey for the last 5 months since the last election. And then we see on Sunday how this plays out.
And you're saying that if he wins a large enough majority that he may as well may go ahead and create himself a dictatorship, name himself president for life, something like that?
Well, he's taken over most centers of power here, you know. This week, you know, the police simply moved into a company that owned a couple of newspapers and a couple of television stations that were hostile to the government. The state television sort of permanently focused on Erdogan as leader and his party. Almost none of the other parties practically get no coverage. He's taken and controls the judiciary. He has a strong measure of control over the army, the security forces, the media, everything else. So it's more and more of an authoritarian state here.
Mm-hmm. And now, am I right that there was a time where even a so-called moderate Islamist like him could never get away with this without being overthrown by the military? And is that no longer the case?
Yeah, this was a sort of tradition for a long time in Turkey that the military would intervene, supposedly to defend the secular state. But that's not going to happen anymore. But I think, you know, this is kind of complicated stuff, but I think the thing to sort of keep in mind is, one, that Turkey is, you know, very polarized society between secular and religious, between Kurds and Turks, between different types of Muslims here, and between haves and have-nots. And so already it was, you had a lot of tensions inside Turkey. On top of that, you have an ever-growing crisis to the south of Turkey in Syria, where the Syrian Kurds have taken over most of the border, half the border area with Turkey. Turkey was trying to get rid of President Assad of Syria. They failed to do that. That's looking more and more of a long shot since the Russians moved in. So you have these kind of two crises, one outside the country, one affecting Turkey and one inside, and they've sort of grown together. And that's really what's destabilizing this country.
Mm-hmm. And then you say that now that the Russians have intervened in Syria in a serious way against the Islamic State and in essence for, I don't know if directly or not, but at least indirectly for the Kurds, that that makes the Erdogan government that much more worried about their so-called Kurdish problem inside Turkey.
Yeah, I mean, they have this sort of quasi-Kurdish state. There are a couple of million plus Kurds in Turkey. When the border between Turkey and Syria was first laid down, and it just runs along the old railway track between Aleppo and Mosul. And there were Kurds caught on the southern side inside Syria. They're not no different from the Kurds in Turkey. They were marginalized under Assad. They were discriminated against. But in 2012, the Syrian army withdrew. They kind of set up their own quasi-state. They have a powerful army. They're allied to the U.S. They get airstrikes. So suddenly this really worries the Turks, who can see this affecting their own Kurdish population, which is about sort of 15 to 20% of the population here. So you have these things going together, and that's kind of one of the things that makes the crisis so big here.
Mm-hmm. And when we hear about Turkish airstrikes against Kurdish positions, is that that's mostly the PKK in Iraq that they're attacking?
PKK in Iraq and southeast Turkey. I'm not sure how much good it does them. You know, the PKK is dug into the Kandil Mountains, big gorges, steep valleys, caves. They're very experienced. I don't think they lose too much. Probably the same in Turkey. You know, these airstrikes, U.S. or Turkish, they kind of don't work too well. You know, when they announce, you know, we are attacking headquarters of some guerrilla force, you know, it's a bit like Vietnam or something. You know, guerrillas don't really have headquarters, you know. So it's not that effective. What is kind of effective is if it's done in partnership, you know, with an effective army on the ground, like the Syrian Kurds. And now, of course, the Russians have moved into Syria, and they're cooperating with the Syrian army, who's giving them about 400, 800 coordinates a day. They don't bomb quite that number, but you know, they had earlier in the week, over a couple of days, they had about 118 airstrikes. The U.S.-led coalition had exactly one over the same period. So you can see the balance of power changing in this part of the world.
Mm-hmm. All right, now, so when they're announcing, I mean, the way I understand it, Obama was going to announce it, and instead they just sent out the press secretary. I don't know what that really symbolizes, if anything. Amateur Kremlinologist.
I think, Scott, you know, whenever I hear that special forces are being sent somewhere or other, I always think this is a bit of a smokescreen. It's governments, in this case the U.S. government, wanting to show to its own people, its own voters, that it's doing something. And you know, special forces, everybody's seen movies about these, you know, magically effective groups. So it kind of looks like action, but it usually happens when governments can't think what to do. And using some special forces, you know, at the worst, you might lose some people, but it's not going to war in any big sense. Mostly it's a bit of a political smokescreen.
Mm-hmm. Give them the ability to claim some small victories, like a prison rescue, something like that. So that makes sense.
Yeah, but now, small victories. You suffer a small defeat, it's not too bad, but it shows action, you know.
Right.
It's like drones, you know.
Okay, but
you know,
so
they announce in Yemen or, you know, Pakistan that they've hit the assistant deputy commander of some Taliban group. You know, it sounds sort of significant, but you know, usually it's he's replaced by his younger brother or something who's even tougher than he is, you know. So it's all kind of a bit meaningless, really, to my mind.
Mm-hmm. All right, now here's the thing that you know, obviously it is the most worrisome thing, not in the sense that it's the most likely problem, All right, y'all, hang on. We'll be right back. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for MPV Engineering. This isn't for all of you, but for high-end contractors specializing in industrial construction and end users who own and operate industrial equipment, MPV offers licensed professional consulting on chemical and mechanical engineering for your projects. Tanks, pressure vessels, piping, heat exchangers, HVAC equipment, chemical reactors for oil companies or manufacturing facilities, as well as project management support and troubleshooting for those implementing designs. MPV will get your industrial project up and running. Head over to mpvengineering.com. All right, y'all, Scott Horton Show. More of that Patrick Coburn interview I recorded last Friday to wrap up for today. Mm-hmm. All right, now, here's the thing that, you know, obviously is the most worrisome thing, not in the sense that it's the most likely problem, maybe, but in the sense that it could be the problem with the most severe consequences, and that is the Americans and the Russians getting tangled up hating each other, but fighting some of the same targets, attacking some of the same targets on the ground there, fighting for and against some of the same factions and some not, and it seems like a real knot. And I wonder if you think that there's a danger that we're going to have American and Russian planes ending up in dogfights over Syria, or maybe, you know, if there's a likelihood of accidental or deliberate Russian attack that costs the lives of American soldiers that could end up turning this ridiculous, horrible war into something much worse.
I suppose there always is a chance that something like that will happen, you know. You know, when you think back over the Cold War, you know, suddenly somebody shoots down a Korean airliner, which is the Russian Soviet shot down a Korean airliner because it was where they thought some American spy plane was, and the Korean airliner sort of got its navigation screwed up and so forth. But sort of accidents like that are always likely to happen. The same thing when this Malaysian airliner was shot down over eastern Ukraine. So all that's possible. It, you know, it's a very sort of messy situation. That there you have the Russians attacking mostly the non-ISIS but jihadi al-Qaeda type Syrian opposition, the U.S. attacking ISIS. But in some ways they got interests in common, but they're also rivals. You never quite know which way it's going to go. You never quite know also, you know, within the U.S., you know, does the State Department have one policy and the Pentagon another, and intelligence agency a third policy. When you have messy situations like this, you also sort of governments, sort of government institutions sort of face all ways.
Mm. Well, isn't it ironic? Do you find it as puzzling as me that even a year and a half after the declaration of the Islamic State, that America continues to arm and back and support at least some of these rebel factions against the Assad government, which ultimately is only to the benefit of Baghdadi and his friends?
Yeah, it's sort of, you know, it's just a policy full of contradictions because, you know, there's a pretense that, you know, somehow there are there used to be a pretense that there were moderate opposition faction that were against both Assad and ISIS. Then they sort of had to admit, you know, what was it? There were four guys there. So then there was an attempt really by the backers of these groups, Jabhat al-Nusra, which is the official representative of al-Qaeda, and Ahrar al-Sham, which comes out of Muslim Brotherhood, but is also related to al-Qaeda, that somehow to relabel them, rebrand them as moderates. And the Qataris and the Saudis and the Turks were trying to do that. I'm not sure how successful they've been. You know, they're trying to distinguish them from ISIS, from Islamic State. But actually, they're all the same kind of guys.
You know, it seems like you know, people spin this as though Assad is just an ally of the Islamic State somehow because they make the insurgency look bad or something. But they don't really seem to mostly focus on fighting Assad. And they do, of course, you know, at some times, and have obviously, you know, massacred Syrian army prisoners and that kind of thing. So obviously they're not allies at all. But they sort of seem to focus on holding the ground they've got. And from here, I don't know, what do I know, Patrick? But from Texas, it looks to me like the Islamic State basically uses Ahrar al-Sham and whatever so-called FSA groups and al-Nusra as their useful idiots who go and do the fighting and dying and taking the territory for them. And then they come in and consolidate and expand their territory slowly but surely, while these other guys are making the ultimate sacrifice on their behalf. But I don't know if what exactly is the relationship between these groups,
State,
really.
Where has it been fighting? It hasn't been doing much fighting in Iraq recently. It's been doing some fighting. It took Palmyra, then it moved quite close to the main road, north-south road, north of Damascus up to Aleppo. It's taken some positions just south of Aleppo, kind of sealing off Aleppo. These are quite important moves. Probably Islamic State. You know, in all this fighting, Islamic State usually turns out to be much tougher and more effective than people think. You know, that happened at Mosul, it happened. But it keeps on happening. They keep on underestimating it. You know, and there's no doubt, you know, the focus has been on the Russian intervention, you know, started on the 30th of September. But what hasn't had much focus on it is that the US-led air campaign, which started, August last year, in Iraq and September in, Syria, simply hasn't worked. There have been 7,000 airstrikes, mostly by the US, but Islamic State is still there and hasn't really been contained. You know, you get these, Central Command, CENTCOM, produced this, famous map showing that ISIS was falling back and lost territory. You know, but it was kind of greeted with derision by anybody who knew the situation there. So the failure of that air campaign, I think, hasn't really penetrated people's minds yet. Mm-hmm. But it is one of the big facts, and that it kind of created a vacuum, which is why the Russians were able to move in.
Well, okay, so what if a hawk argued that, well, America just doesn't have reliable enough partners on the ground in Iraq because the Iraqi army is, you know, hardly exists, and they can't directly work with the Shiite militias that are under Iranian control, and the Kurds can kind of only go so far, but maybe the Russians are in a position, if they're backing the Syrian army with air power, that they actually could roll the jihadists back. Not that I'm saying I'd be for that, but do you think that's within the realm of possibility that Russia's air war?
You know, the peculiarity of U.S. policy, you know, it's been the same weakness, not just this year, last year, since Islamic State appeared on the horizon, but really going right back to 9/11. The U.S. wants to maintain its good relations with these powerful Sunni states. Like Saudi Arabia, you know, after 9/11, you know, remember 15 out of 19 hijackers were Saudis. Bin Laden was a Saudi. The U.S. official in Senate inquiry showed that the money for 9/11 came from private donors in Saudi Arabia and the Gulf. But, you know, the U.S. goes and attacks Iraq. You know, it doesn't blame or even whisper criticism at Saudi Arabia. Similarly in Afghanistan, you know, they went after the Taliban in Afghanistan, but the Taliban were really the creation of Pakistan, another big Sunni state, but the U.S. Never confronted them. Now, the same thing is really happening now, that they know, you know, that the main backers of Jabhat al-Nusra and Ahrar al-Sham and all these jihadis is really the neighboring Sunni states. None of these people would really be in business unless the Turkish border was at least partly over. But they don't want to break relations with these Sunni states. So that's kind of the bedrock of U.S. power in the Middle East. it really doesn't want to alienate these states, but not alienating them means it can't really go after Islamic State.
Mm-hmm. Well, now,
for instance, it doesn't dare go, you know, when the Syrian army was fighting Islamic State, it wouldn't attack Islamic State because that might be seen as keeping Assad in power, and that wouldn't go down badly in Ankara or in Riyadh in Saudi Arabia. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the reasons they didn't really have partners on the ground.
All right. Although, on the other hand, though, you know, that kind of makes it sound like there really is a possibility for the success of talks here. If America insisted that its allies take this seriously, I mean, they are, after all, have invited even Iran, no Syrians, but they are sitting down and having at least preliminary type talks, including even the Iranians and the Russians. And it seems like if America could get its allies to cut off the Islamic State, it'll wither pretty quickly. They're landlocked. If they can't sell their oil to the Turks and they can't get their men across the border from the Turks and they're surrounded by enemies, they're at least a lot more vulnerable that way if somehow the Saudi government would actually stop bankrolling them. No?
Yeah, I mean, they're vulnerable to that, you know, to supplies not getting through. You know, will that happen? I sort of doubt it, you know, because I don't think they'll want to, Washington want to put that kind of pressure on its Sunni allies in the region. It certainly hasn't done so before. Yeah. But, you know, there is movement. I mean, I felt when the Russians intervened,